want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them, is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Sirius XM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough! Horse racing, handicapping,
interviews.
This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. Hour three, basically, a couple of minutes ahead, and going to get John White in here momentarily, and we'll I think we'll be regaled with some stories about exotic wood. I think any number of people might it predates. That's 20 plus years ago, 25. And John White, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you this morning? Good morning from Southern California, where, as Charles Hatton, the great Charles Hatton, once characterized the weather, the sort of weather that makes umbrellas important.
Well, nobody, it's one of those scenarios. I mean, even with some mudslides and some other issues here and there, nobody's complaining, given the protracted drought conditions. Hammer was talking about it on Friday. And then, in fact, yesterday, I guess he went for a, he was going for a hike, and he said there was a little, like a creek that, or as we call them in upstate New York, creek, that was actually running water. He said he hadn't seen it in forever, water running through it. So it does seem that this is well received.
Interesting that you would say creek, because that's where I grew up. That's what we would say, and my wife, early on in our relationship, when I said crick one day, she said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "I'm talking about that crick." And she said, "No, it's not crick, it's creek." Well, that brings back a fond memory there of having kind of the record set straight of the actual pronunciation of that. But you are so right, Steve. We do need the water desperately. There's no getting around that. That's for sure.
Well, the track has adjusted in terms of training, and you know, Dick Powell. I'm going to do, I hope, a service to everybody. Those who keep squawking every time there's a cancellation of a card. And they probably aren't even aware that in a lot of cases, training also is suspended, in the day after, the racetrack is sealed. Dick Powell on Wednesday, I will have him outline the litany, the historic litany of the dangers of a racetrack the day, literally, you know, the next day after, being sealed and being, you know, packed down, and then until it gets a chance to fully dry and get, you know, reoriented and you know, having the cushion fluffed up, probably would be good to have Dr. Peterson too, to Mick Peterson, to explain this too. But Dick was the first person, John, and then, you know, I'm sure over the years when you've listened, you recall, you know, Dick laying out, you know, what must have started out anecdotally, but then, you know, the empirical evidence is very much there that the dangers of, you know, of concussive injury and, you know, particularly what's been learned about, I could get Dr. Alday too to expand on this, what's been learned about fissures and microfractures, you know, the beginnings of more involved fractures, and what, you know, what that kind of a racetrack does, the dangers involved. So everyone has to just adjust their thinking and appreciate the, you know, the motivation for, you know, not running under those circumstances.
Well, not only from a safety standpoint, but also to me from a horse playing standpoint, you know, for years and years and years here in Southern California, they would card these cards, and you would look at the weather, and it would say, Saturday, 100% chance of rain, or 95% chance of rain. And one thing about it, unlike even as recently as maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago, they've become much more accurate in these weather forecasts. When they say 95, 100, 97, 90, you know, it's a rarity when they're wrong. And, I mean, they have nailed it here in the Los Angeles area since the start of the meet. And it's raining right now. They predicted it would rain today. It's raining right now. What is very encouraging is that once we get past this rain today, looks like we're in for a good long dry patch. And we've drawn the card for next Friday. A nine race card, five turf races, so we're going to get back on the grass unless there's a surprise storm hill. You know, if you get any kind of precipitation, they come off the hill because you have to cross that dirt, especially the way they're running on the grass. Now, it's one thing when you're sitting at Saratoga in the summer and you get those at this meet in terms of being proactive. We had going to be too wet to race on and having a plethora of scratches and you're down to four or five horses. And the other aspect that has come in the rain, they didn't really have any kind of field size. The field size would have had to been for some turf races. And they weren't about to do that because, again, it was like 100% chance of rain today, which it's doing right now.
Now, so they made, so obviously they made the right choice all along. And you know, we've seen that adjustment too. The racing offices, not just limited to Southern California, we've seen it here too. When they know that there's an advance for, you know, and a chance, a serious chance for rain mid card. So we'll see if there's going to be any turf races. They'll be, you know, the first and the third or the second and the fourth. And then, you know, the rest of the card on the main track. Racetracks have also done what Santa Anita did for yesterday, you know, knowing full well that the turf, you know, you weren't going to tear the turf up this early in the meet. So, you know, an all dirt card. There's signs of life when it comes to understanding and appreciating, you know, the way the players are going to approach things. And, you know, I got to say, I mean, since this topic came up, John, there was a period of time where I never understood how to approach, off turf races and, specifically, Andy Serling helped cure me of that, and the, you know, the ability to re-handicap essentially and look at races, you know, once you've been made aware of who's coming out, and also what a good opportunity the off the turf races can be. Andy goes out of his way to explain this to people because very frequently, especially you mentioned Saratoga, especially at Saratoga, there's opportunities, glaring opportunities, where the public bets the race as if it was still on the grass and are completely overlooking horses that are going to move up considerably under those conditions. And it you know, doesn't have to be as simple as you know, just using MTOs, for instance, although using MTOs is certainly a good habit in practice, but there's horses that stay in, you know, on the main track very frequently. Shug and Bill Mott, very frequently stay in, no matter what. And Andy helped cure me of being hesitant to you know, play off the turf. One of my best Saratoga days ever came on an off the turf card, where I hit multiple, had two signers, and that's how I got to know Tina. Tina was working the IRS window, and I had the opportunity to stand there for 15, 20 minutes and talk to her. So I'm all in on off the turf.
Well, Andy, I've heard him talk about that many times. It's a kind of a golden opportunity. Really, from the standpoint, we don't get many opportunities to get inflated prices on horses these days because of the proliferation of information at our fingertips. And this is a situation in which that's true. One thing I wish they would go back to doing, they did it for a year or two here in Southern California, but I haven't seen it lately, and that is, you said MTOs, that's the main track only entrance. And there are horses entered here in Southern California, main track only, but they don't put it in the past performances or in the program. So we're in the dark on that, and I'm never in favor of the public being in the dark for anything that should be, you know, shed light on. And that is an important piece of information to know who was entered as a main track only. All the years I was on HRTV, I was amazed how many times on the East Coast where horses would be entered as an MTO, it would rain, the race would come off the turf, and then you'd have two or three main track only horses scratch. I'm going, what the heck?
Well yeah.
These guys got what they wanted, and now they're not even running. So
exactly.
What the heck's going on there? But what leads to the inflated prices in some cases, the morning line is made for the turf. It is not made for the dirt. So I hear a lot, for instance, on the radio programs here in Southern California sometimes in a race that's taken off the turf, and the handicapper will still quote the boarding line. He'll go, hey, I like this horse at 10-1. Well, he would have been 10-1 in a full field on the turf, but in a 4-horse, 5-horse field on the dirt, he's going to be like 8-5 or 5-2. I mean, it's ridiculous to even be quoting that morning line, but because of the fact that the players, that's what they're going off of, is that turf morning line, here's a case where it is skewing things a little bit. And
yeah,
some of the more, less experienced players and so forth, they're thinking, hey, I can bet this horse at maybe a decent price. And especially in the multi-race wagers where they're looking down the line and they don't see the actual wagering for that race. So, you know, this is what part of what's great about this sport to me, Steve, and it has been always. It's one of the things that got me interested as a youngster in the 60s in horse racing was the more you learn about horse racing, the more you know that there's more to learn. And I would sit there at breakfast with the American Racing Manual day after day after day, just pouring through that thing. What an education that was. And you know, we learn all the time. Charlie Whittingham once told me one morning at Santa Anita, I'm still learning. That's about as close as I came to fainting at a racetrack as I ever did, because I'm sitting there thinking, if this guy's still learning,
yeah,
I'll never, you know, I'll always be learning, that's for sure. And, you know, you talk about how you hated races down the hill, but
yep,
Rick Hammerly helped,
yep,
you know, you with a good approach to the races down
absolutely
the hill and going with those turn back or cut back horses going a shorter distance. And here's a case where, again, main track only horse, you know, races taken off the turf, I can understand why some people might, you know, be you know, bothered by that or worried about that, but it actually, what can be perceived to be a weakness can turn into a strength, as articulated by Andy Serling.
There you go. Well, John, a couple of quick notes about yesterday before we talk about Exotic Wood. I gave the number Hijazi a 97. I'm sure that my man Gary Young and Amr Zidane happy with that comebacker. Gives them a something to work off of and try to get him into the three-year-old pictures. And then, of course, you had a terrific, that La Cañada ended up being a real thriller.
Well, that La Cañada really was. It came down to, I mean, a dramatic photo finish. I kept thinking that Ganador was going to go by. I mean, not go by, but hold on. And then I kept thinking that the eventual winner of the race, Kirsten Bosch, was going to go by. I mean, they locked into a really fierce battle in that final furlong. And congratulations to Kazushi Kimura, who got his first Santa Anita win, not only his first Santa Anita stakes win and first Santa Anita graded stakes win, but his first win at the Great Race Place. And what a ride. You know, he was locked in battle with Hall of Famer John Velasquez, and it really was a terrific race. Kirsten Bosch, I made 5-2 on the morning line. She was kind of a tricky call because I wasn't sure. She ran awfully well in the La Brea, I thought. And so I wasn't sure if she would actually go down or up from that price. I thought there was a chance she might even go down, but she drifted up a notch to 3. And again, Adero did go off as the favorite, who I did have as the favorite. And so that was a good race. And then Hijazi, I was very interested to see what buyer he would get for that performance. One of the things I think that added to his performance was the fact he didn't break alertly and rushed up early. So he expended a lot of energy in that first quarter. And then it looked to me like Mike Smith had things well under control in that last part of the race. And Hijazi, you know, cost over $3 million at the sale. And here again, what a tremendous job Gary Young has done picking these horses out. Just incredible what he's done. Yeah, they've spent a lot of money, but a lot of people spend a lot of money. And boy, Gary Young's eye for a horse at these sales is second to none. And I think Hijazi, I really like the way they backed off him after he ran in the last time out as a two-year-old. They put him in the stakes race there, and you know, as a maiden. And it looked to me at that time that he could stand to maybe get some time off and get some time to grow up and just kind of regroup. They did that, and I think it's going to pay dividends. There are those that think maybe he's just a sprinter with that pedigree. I don't know where that's coming from. He's by Bernardini out of a Medallia d'Oro mare. He galloped out well after the finish of this race. So I don't look at him as a pure sprinter myself. Maybe that's what it'll turn out to be. But for me, I think he's got every right to be a two-turn horse. And he just adds to that strength. You know, Bob Baffert's so strong right now with these three-year-olds, just like Brad Cox is in the Midwest with his band of three-year-olds. So that was quite a performance by Hijazi. It was very important for him to get out of the maiden ranks, and he did so, and he did so nicely.
Well, we look ahead to the coming week, and we'll talk to Hammer tomorrow as well, which will be a bit of a throwback conversation, but fairly still quiet next week. The Astra on Saturday, and then things start to pick up a little bit. The Las Virginis at the end of the month, the San Pascal, and start to look ahead to the Bob Lewis and the other lead ups toward the Santa Anita. I got the San Vicente actually first, even ahead of that, the 7/8. I suppose we're going to see, Speedboat Beach in the San Vicente as well.
And he should be very tough in there, that's for sure. You made the point in terms of the Jazzy, and it's an outstanding point. How often do you see a two-year-old post a 100 buyer and make it get beat?
Exactly. It's crazy. Crazy.
That was a track for record performance that day by Speedboat Beach. So, you know, it'll be very interesting to see him get back on the dirt after these grass performances, particularly insofar as the difference between that 100 buyer on the dirt and his grass buyers. I mean, Well, you just figure he's going to be loaded for bear when he gets back on the dirt in the San Vicente.
Well, John, let me kind of turn back the clock kind of a conversation too. That I was up in the middle of the night, and I hadn't before I went to sleep. I went to bed early because I just wasn't feeling right. But you may have noticed. I think I probably sent that response back to you at 2 o'clock in the morning. Exotic wood, this will be a new conversation for some people, but for players and fans of a certain age, certainly a name from the past that they'll enjoy hearing again.
Well, back in the 1990s, Exotic Wood, trained by Ron Ellis, who also had twice the vice, he had a powerful 1-2 punch in these two female thoroughbreds. And Mr. and Mrs. Marty Wygod raced twice the vice. Originally, was Bob and Beverly Lewis and Ray Bell. But Exotic Wood, also for the Wygods and Ron Ellis. And Frank Angst of Blood Horse reported just the other day that Exotic Wood, as you said, died at the age of 30. She died from the infirmities of old age, which the fact that she was 30 was... gave me pause right there, considering yeah. I was right there for her career. But, how good was she? Well, she won 8 of her first 9 career starts. She was 8-for-9 to begin with. And her one loss might have been the best performance of her career. It was certainly one of them. And it was a race, the Grade 1 Santa Monica Handicap of 1996 at Santa Anita. And this was a big, big, big deal at the time, because in the race was Serena Song, trained by Dwayne Lucas and owned by Bob and Beverly Lewis. And Serena Song was coming off a campaign in 1995 in which she was the Eclipse Award-winning 3-year-old filly, winning races like the Haskell and the Beldame. In the Beldame, she beat Heavenly Prize in Lakeway. I mean, wow. Serena Song, of course, a Hall of Famer, would be inducted into the Hall of Fame. And she's by Rahi and Exotic Wood. By Rahi, and Exotic Wood went into the Santa Monica undefeated in 5 starts, and coming off a clear-cut win in the Grade 2 La Brea Stakes. At that time, the La Brea was a Grade 2. And so you had this showdown that the track really played up, and it really caught on with the fans. You had the undefeated daughter of Rahi at one corner in Exotic Wood, and the Eclipse Award-winning daughter of Rahi, Serena Song, in the other corner. And in the race, Serena Song carried top weight of 123 pounds, Exotic Wood 118. So Serena Song was at a disadvantage in terms of the weights. And Serena Song also was in a disadvantage in that she was coming off a layoff. She hadn't raced since the Breeders' Cup. This is late January, so she's making her first start of the year. Whereas Exotic Wood was coming into the race off that win in the La Brea on December 30th. So she had the recency advantage as well. To show you how close the two were perceived by the bettors, Exotic Wood went off at even money. Serena Song went off at even money. Huh. And Serena Song was the slight favorite in the race, with just a little more money on her as the favorite. So that was really a memorable race at the Great Race Place for sure.
Well, there's also a part of Exotic Wood's career that throws back to an era, or at least an element of Breeders' Cup history. Participated in the sprint, and that was the one at Hollywood in 97, and that was Elmhurst's Breeders' Cup sprint. Ran well, was beaten less than 2 lengths for everything, finished 4th. McCarron pretty much rode her regularly, right?
That's right, and he was aboard that day as well. In fact, that was another aspect of that showdown in the Santa Monica. You had Gary Stevens on Serena's song, and you had McCarron on his other foot, so 2 of the all-time great jockeys. And after that Santa Monica, by the way, of all the hundreds of post-race TV interviews I ever did, it remains my favorite, as I interviewed Gary Stevens, Dwayne Lucas, and then Bob Lewis. And the thing that made that my favorite post-race interview on TV ever. Bob Lewis, this was a great illustration of his class. I mean, one of the classiest persons I've ever known. And when I said, Mr. Lewis, what were your thoughts on the race? You know, he could have said, well, we showed them or something of that ilk, you know. But the first thing, he went out of his way to congratulate Pam and Marty Wygod as the owners, the trainer of Exotic Wood, Ron Ellis, and the jockey, Chris McCarron. They said, I just want to congratulate them, but what an outstanding performance by their filly. And that was just so classy to me at that moment, with all the buildup for that race. And it would have been easy for a guy to kind of brag a little bit. Listen, Serena Song, there was plenty to brag about. And he was certainly proud of her performance and everything, but he didn't lead off with Serena Song. He led off with congratulating the people he had just beaten.
Now, Bob Lewis, I mean, a treasure, Bob and Beverly Lewis. I remember saying at the time of the passing, there's a famous, I think it was an Evan Shipman. Was it an Evan Shipman? You speak about the American Racing Manual, John, and I remember coming across, it might have been, I want to say it's Shipman. It's funny, I've gone back to look at it, look for the quote again, and I haven't been able to find it. Actually, I wonder now, speaking aloud, if it was in W.H.P. Robertson's book, The History of Thoroughbred Racing in America. But
which I have sitting right here within arm's length of my desk, that book that you just referred to.
For those, and people have heard me say it before in terms of a reference. It's not a, when I say reference, I mean as a introduction to the game's history. There's simply nothing better. It is long out of stock, and you're going to have to get it at a rare bookstore. Start looking for it on eBay and such, and other, you know, secondhand purveyors of books. But The History of Thoroughbred Racing in America by W.H.P. Robertson is the quintessential history of the game, and if you read it once or twice, you will have a base of knowledge about the game's history that you know, from which you can launch in any direction. But the quote in essence, John, was, you know, the death of any one man diminishes you know, all of us, but the likes of a Bob Lewis is, you know, even more profound. I that's why it drives me crazy that I can't find this this quote, because there's certain people, when it comes to the game, there's, you know, a handful of people every now and then you can apply it to. But the, you know, Exotic Wood is a fun horse for this conversation. You know, I've wanted to do that Horses the Time Forgot segment, John, and that's what this is. This is a horse that, you know, made 890,000 in 17 career starts, and she had a little bit more than a useful career as a broodmare. And it's actually interesting, and I love that she had a long life post her broodmare career. You know, very often you see, you know, a broodmare, she has her last baby at 23 and dead at 24, as opposed to stallions who get to live out their days. A lot of times broodmares, you know, don't get to, you know, be lawn ornaments and just graze and be comfortable. But her career is really, if a horse like this came along, I mean, this is basically Beholder in the 90s.
Well, that's a good comparison. I mean, believe me, if you take a look at the two records side by side from their first career start through the first, say, 3 years, boy, there's a great similarity there, that's for sure. By the way, you mentioned Bob Lewis again, and one thing I always liked that he met his wife, Beverly, at Portland Meadows, that go into the races, so that was always, and they went to the University of Oregon, which is where he met her. but they would go to Portland Meadows while they were in college, and their silks were the Oregon University of Oregon colors. That's where they got those colors. And one time when I was, you know, he was in the winner's circle so often, and one time doing the TV interview with him after he won a stakes race, Mike Willman was often doing those at that in those years at Hollywood Park. And so I, whatever race it was, I said, congratulations, Mr. Lewis, you know, on this victory. What were your thoughts on the race? And he goes, well, Mike, and, you know, I wasn't about to correct the guy or whatever. And so, you know, I got upstairs and I told Kurt Hoover, I said, you know, Kurt, I said that Mr. Lewis just called me Mike. And, you know, I kind of chuckled. And lo and behold, the next morning, I'm sitting in the press box at Santa Anita. And I'm told there's a phone call for you. I go over to the phone, I pick it up, and it's Bob Lewis.
Unbelievable.
And he says, John, did I call you Mike yesterday?
Unbelievable.
And I said, well, Mr. Lewis, yes, but it was fine. I said, truthfully, you can call me anything. And he says, I feel so terrible. I said, Mr. Lewis, don't worry about it. I said, it's fine. But that guy, that's how genuine he was.
That's
great. You get people that, you know, come across that way, but they're kind of phony. There wasn't a phony bone in that guy's body. I mean, he was so authentic and so genuine and just, you know, he is so missed. I mean, you know, and his wife too, Beverly, was just, you know, something special herself. So, and you just couldn't help but smile when they had success. I mean, they were just the type of people you couldn't help rooting for. I mean, even if I lost a bet on a race, if I lost to them, it wasn't quite so bad.
I agree, and I was delighted to have had a chance to meet him. And he's one of those people that you meet that, you know, in the game on the ownership side that you just, you know, it's almost kind of a starstruck we think about the jocks and the trainers, you know, that you'd be starstruck. But if, from an ownership standpoint, you know, if you grew up around the game at a certain time, I mean, Bob and Beverly Lewis were, you know, they were glitterati. And Baffert always talks about whenever they come up, how Bob Lewis is the only person that would call him Robert.
Yep, Robert. That's right.
and the way, and there was sort of a clipped way in which he would, Robert, he just said, I'd pick up the phone and he'd, Robert. It makes me smile just thinking about it. I'm tickled that that this came up about Exotic Wood because, you know, Arahi Mare, and for those that haven't seen the record printed out, 17 starts, 11 wins, 3 seconds and a third, was only off the board, off the board, was beaten, as I said, 1 3-quarter lengths in the Breeders' Cup Sprint to Elmhurst, He's a Bull, and good old Bet on Sunshine, Paul McGee, but never failed to cash a check in her whole career. Was fourth twice and third once, otherwise in the exact every time. And actually, even that fourth, that fourth up at Golden Gate, that came off of a layoff and a pretty extensive layoff. You know, John, it's funny. She ran in the Gopher Wand, and I don't. Boy, that is, 96 would have been right in my wheelhouse for when I was at Saratoga, and I do not remember that Gopher Wand I at all. I'd have to go through my stuff. She beat Shoop and Frolic, but I do not remember her coming to New York. That was her lone East Coast trip. Hold it, I'm wrong.
By her was her career debut, because I was having lunch with my wife at a Marie Callender's restaurant near Santa Anita. And Exotic Wood was in the first race at Del Mar. And I said, I got to cut lunch short here because I'm going over to bet a horse. And it was Exotic Wood. Now, she was even money that day, but she had a work tab. And this is before we really had access to these, you know, the Andy Harrington type things and so forth, which I don't have for the morning line, unfortunately. But if you knew Ron Ellis and the way he prepared horses for their first race, these workouts were just outlandish. I mean, And then when you went with the pedigree, you know, By Rahi out of a Dixieland Band mare, and Dixieland Band, one of my all-time favorite broodmare sires, this thing just had the looks of a future star right out of the box. And she, the fact she was even money shows she was certainly no secret, but she won, and there was never really, she never looked like losing that race, and I hammered it, her that day. And so I'll always have that very fond memory of her as well. But like I say, very sobering, the fact that she died at the age of 30. Where does the time go? It's unbelievable that she would be 30. I can't believe it.
Four-time grade one winner, the Santa Maria, the Santa Monica, the Gopher Wand, and I thought there was a fourth. One, two, three. I guess three-time grade one winner. Never failed to place. Against females anyway, never failed to place in a grade one either. The career finale, and this is from distances of 6 to 1 mile and 1/8. The Gopher Wand was 1 mile and 1/8. That was the longest win of her career. She was second in the Santa Margarita, and she got beat in her career finale in the A-Gleam.
I mentioned that Ron Ellis also had twice the Vice in the barn at that same time, and she was a multiple grade one winner as well, won the Apple Blossom, and grade ones here in Southern California. I mean, that was just, you know, to have those two in your barn at the same time was a wow. I mean, to have both of those was at that particular time was really something for trainer Ron Ellis.
Won the La Brea. That was her first grade one win. She won at Del Mar, Hollywood, Santa Anita. She did come east, actually. Also earlier that year, she came east to Belmont and won the Genuine Risk. Wow.
Yep.
Wow, she beat Lots of Talc and Miss Golden Circle.
And she won the Vanity, beating Jewel Princess, and the Vanity at that time. I mean, that was a huge deal here in Southern California for sure. So, I mean, like I say, to have just one of those two in your barn would be outstanding, but to have both Exotic Wood and twice the Vice at the same time, and, you know, and to juggle where to run the two of them as well. I mean, Ron just did a terrific job with both of them. They were both very, very talented.
The best horse she dropped was Key to Power, an AP Indy. And not actually, not that, it's only 10 years ago, Key to Power.
Exotic Wood. That's right.
And I want to pull him up because I do not remember who Brendan Walsh. How about that? Wow. I mean, that's got to be right at the start of Brendan's career.
Speaking of him, I'm very high on Brandishing, who is entered in an undercard race on the LeCompte card. I just was blown away by his maiden win. And I went back and watched his debut loss at Churchill, and that loss, you have to see it to really appreciate it, because looking at that race on paper does it no justice. But he was on just way out in the parking lot all the way down the backside, made a huge move on the far turn, and actually reached virtually even terms for the lead turning into the stretch. And based on how far he ran that day and the mid-race move he made, it's not shocking he lost his punch in the lane. And but boy, that maiden win was really eye-popping to me in New Orleans. I think he's one of the real serious three-year-old that we have right now.
The card is terrific on Saturday, and it's going to be a long day. It's 14, one of these 14 race, one of these 14 race cards.
Yeah. It's a marathon.
It's a marathon, not a sprint, as they said. I don't really, let me pull out the, have you sent down an early, your early three-year-old missives?
Yes, I have Arabian Knight at the top of the list right now, and he's working in passion for his first start of the year. Forte I have in the number two spot. I think, you know, he does. A lot of people have him number one. I can't blame him for that. I mean, a three-time grade one winner as a two-year-old, and certainly understanding there. But I have Cyclone Mischief and Brandishing both high on my list. That Cyclone Mischief, that's another race to me that was very impressive. I was listening very closely with your interview with Dale Romans, and I know people chuckle, you know, it's sort of like, here's one for you. Mel Studi was always, you know, he never ran a horse that he didn't think was going to win, and he always saw the glasses half full. And my wife came home one day prior to the Breeders' Cup 1987 at Hollywood Park and said, I've got a Breeders' Cup winner for you. I said, who's that? She said, very subtle in the sprint. I said, she's got no chance against Groovy. Are you kidding me? She says, yeah, but Mel really likes her. And I said, Mel likes everything. That doesn't mean anything. And lo and behold, I called that chart for the racing form. So if you go back into the Breeders' Cup archives, that chart, those are my margins and my chart comments for that race. I'm sitting there as they're coming to the finish going, oh, my God, I'm going to be hearing about this for the rest of my life, how very subtle, deep, Groovy this day. And my wife makes maybe one or two bets a year. And, of course, she bet $2 on very subtle that day. Fortunately, I didn't, mainly because I was calling the chart, I was, and the short price on Groovy, I didn't go down on flames on Groovy, who did not win that day. But and by the way, very subtle, and this is for those with the Long Acres drinking game, her sire, Hoist the Silver, was a star in the Pacific Northwest. It actually ran in the Kentucky Derby, Hoist the Silver, who was by Hoist the Flag, and he raced for the general manager of Yakima Meadows, and was really a good horse, and he won a race, the prep for the Long Acres Derby called the Spokane Handicap of Long Acres. There was a spill coming into the stretch, and the spill was so controversial that there was that Hoist the Silver did not get disqualified, that they lost a day or two of racing, that the trainers were so upset at the non-call. But I saw a film of that race, and I understand why the stewards didn't make a disqualification, because it happened on the far turn, and particularly in the late 70s, your video quality wasn't exactly outstanding. There were no drones or anything, and that shot, the head-on shot on the far turn, was basically useless. So you were having to go off of the pan, really, to make the call. And how can you tell if a horse is cutting off anybody on the far turn just off the pan shot? So, you know, I'm not saying that Hoist the Silver didn't deserve to come down. Maybe he did, but there was no video evidence that I ever saw that proved that he should come down. But the trainers at Long Acres in those days were very good at getting up in arms over everything, the condition of the track and the racing officials and everything. So they ended up that, but that was one of the most controversial races in the history of Long Acres by the sire of a future Breeders' Cup winner and very subtle.
Well, John, I'm glad you have latched on to the Long Acres drinking game as suggested last week.
That was such a beautiful and special place for all of us that ever went there. It just with, you know, and Emerald Downs is terrific. I mean, it's you know, but for those of us, it'd be like if you took Santa Anita, knocked it down, and put in, you know, a modern facility. It's just not the same. And there was such a charm to Long Acres with the poplar trees on each turn. And look, my dad, my late father, thought that the greatest place on earth, not the greatest place in the United States, the greatest place on earth was the cottage behind the tote board where Joe Gottstein, who built Long Acres, lived. During the racing season. And I got to interview his widow. I never met Joe Gottstein, but I did interview my first year at Longacres with the Racing Form, 1975, Luella Gottstein, I interviewed her in that cottage. And that was a thrill for me, just to be able to get into that cottage, the place where my dad thought, boy, how can you find a better place to live than in the infield at Longacres?
And, you know, and there are that's a funny topic, actually, that might be an interesting, that could be an interesting piece for you know, one of the trades, because there are all around the game, even in this era, there are homes and those kinds of little cottages at Monmouth. There's Wolf Hill at Oaklawn. There's the house, you know, that was a Sella property, family owned. I don't know if they do now. Where else are there? The houses behind Belmont are, you know, they're just homes. There's the road that, you know, that's now actually everybody's selling because of the train station that's being installed or has been installed. But there's a number of those kinds of little domiciles, John, around the game. It's very funny.
Well, I can remember watching after the last race that Luella, she would have her car parked behind the tow board there, too. And after the last race, she would be driving across out of the infield across the track and wherever she was headed after the races. So, like I say, I have so many fond memories of sitting in the grandstand or standing at near the winner's circle there for those races at Longacres. I mean, if I could like snap my fingers and go back in time, I would certainly be very happy to go back to those times with my father. We would be sitting there reading the Racing Form between races, and my father really loved more than anything reading the form in the motel the night before. He was ahead of his time. I mean, you know, that was back before they put the jockeys next to the horses' names in the past performances. He would write down all the jockeys' names. He would underline horses in the company lines to where we have that bold face now when they run against each other. I mean, he did so many things that, I say, were way ahead of his time. He would keep a stack of racing forms. This goes hand in hand with the weather we've been experiencing in California with all the rain. And we, of course, had plenty of rain in the Pacific Northwest. And my dad would keep, about a 2 years file of racing forms. And we did not have at our fingertips like today where you can look in the past performances and see a horse's record on a wet track. And just that right there, that was back in the days of mud marks, which many years when I was a chart caller, I assigned mud marks. And the mud marks, for those old enough that would remember, the mark that looked like an asterisk was a fair mud mark, which would appear next to the horse's name. Then you had an X mud mark, which was good. So you went from fair to good. And then the real rarity was a horse that had the X in a circle.
Right.
And that was a superior mudder. And the last superior mud mark I ever assigned as a chart caller for the Racing Form was to a mare that I think will be familiar with a lot of your listeners, a mare by the name of Bayakoa.
How about that? I love it. Well, John, as always, fun, informative, far-flung, and all. We do it all. It's great to have John White back on a regular basis. Post time, John, on your Twitter. And going back to the beginning of the conversation, John, one of the hyper-responsible line makers that when there are prominent scratches out of stakes or when there's off the turf, he'll come back and provide a revised morning line. One of the great reasons to make sure you're following John on Twitter, too. John, thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
Thanks a lot, Steve. Talk to you next week.
John White, everybody. So great. I don't have like a sponsor for it, but that Horses That Time Forgot HTTF has always been the when I'll print out a career lifetime PPs, and I'll put HTTF, horse the time forgot, and John did it without prompting with exotic wood. I mean, that horse like this comes along these days, we'd go crazy and argue about the difference between the sprint, 6-furlong sprint, and the 7/8 filly and mare sprint. She felt and feels like a horse, you know, that didn't come for another 10 years, but she feels like a horse, right? 2007 was the first filly and mare sprint at Monmouth Merrifield. And she feels like a horse that would have benefited from 7/8 filly and mare sprint. At the time, should ask Ron Ellis that next time we talk to Ron. Going to close out. We got a little less than 10 minutes. The the opportunity to get Pat Morrell to also pay tribute and close out the morning. We had the conversation with Meg, of course, and with Glenn Wismer, chance to add one more voice and an appreciation of a in Lexington, in Versailles, actually. Blackburn and Ward, 5:30 to 7, and then a service at 7. And the family suggests PDJF as a contribution suggestion. So let me get Pat in, and you know, the unscheduled opportunities to go to Presque Isle, both on my way to Kentucky and then back, really makes this even more poignant because of Glenn and the conversation we had with him, and while we were there, and of course with Pat Morrell, who handles all the paddock and simulcast and interview duties, and Pat shaken up as much as anyone, because he had the opportunity to get to know Avery Wisman as well and get to know him well. Pat Morrell, so sorry, as everyone in the industry grapples with the sadness associated with Avery.
No doubt about that, Steve. It's been a lousy week, let me put it that way, down here. A lot of crying this weekend, you know, this past weekend, and after we found out about Avery. And I was just very fortunate. I've got to know him when I was up at Prescott, and, you know, we had a lot of great conversations and spent some time up in the clubhouse together, and, you know, just little things. I actually, you know, got him a mount, you know, on a really nice maiden special weight horse called Shoshana, you know, in the day. But the day that I'm always going to remember, Steve, is, you know, the day his dad came up and he won the Carl Boys with Surly Furious for Mr. Wismer. And you heard the wonderful kind of things that Mr. Wismer had to say. I mean, and you hear that from Glenn Wismer, then it means a lot, because he's such a, I mean, he is like the epitome of a gentleman. But Avery, man, you just, his dad was so proud of him that day and screaming and yelling. I even said in the interview later on, I thought he was going to bring the tote board down because he was screaming so loud. It was just, and you know me, Steve, I'm a very passionate guy, and especially about thoroughbred racing. When I saw that and Avery's dad in the winner's circle with him, and it was magical. There's no question about it. It was, you know, it was almost like Walt Disney, like, you know, this kid, just the way he was, and he was so kind and so polite, and he had this great confidence that was just, it was a quiet confidence. He wasn't arrogant, you know, as some people are, but he was not that way. He was just Steve. Just a wonderful, kind person to be around. And I mean, we're all better because we got to be around him. he was just that kind of person.
Did he have an agent, or was he booking his own? Or
Mike Bish was his agent. Yeah, I talked to Mike this weekend. I talked to Matt Kintz, who he wrote a lot for Matt Kintz. I must have talked to Matt 3 or 4 times this week, just trying to process, both he and I, both trying to process this whole tragedy. And it's just, what can you say? You know, you say prayers for him, and you say prayers for his family, and what do you do? It's just horrible, man.
Well,
it's absolutely horrible.
And you and I, you know, I reached out to you when someone had asked me, I think on, I can look on the phone, but on Wednesday or Thursday, have you heard a rumor that a rider was killed? And so, you know, your first thought is always that, you know, some sort of an accident. And so, the initial kinds of things that came back after confirmation really did not make it apparent what had transpired. And so there was already one wave of, you know, just feeling awful, hearing that news. And then, you know, then the additional, level of despair and just, you know, heart sickness that is leaving so many people feeling. Even Glenn kind of hinted that he was feeling like, was there more that I could have done? And it added another layer to what was already a desperately sad circumstance.
Exactly. And it's, you know, I hadn't, my girlfriend Cass, Judd, and I, you know, we talked about this ad nauseum the last, 5, 6 days, whatever, however long it's been. And it was weird because he explained to me where his parents' farm is in Versailles. And I'm pretty sure I know, like, the area where it's at. And I was driving past the Versailles exit on 64, taking a horse for surgery down to Simpsonville for my girlfriend. And I said, you know, I need to call Avery. And this was on Tuesday. Mm. I haven't talked to him in forever. And then I got distracted and I didn't do it. And you know me, Steve. I'm very communicative with people. I communicate very, very well. And I thought about him that day and I didn't call him. And now I'm just so beside myself because I didn't do it. Was it going to change anything? Probably not. I don't know. We don't know.
No, you just don't know.
But I just wish I would have got to talk to him, you know? And it's just like, you know, and I think that's the thing that resonates so much with what Mr. Wismer had to say today. We always, people, need to quit worrying about ourselves so much. And we need to worry about our friends and our family and people that really do need us more. We need to do more that way. And I think that resonated with me so much today when Mr. Wismer said that. And like I said, listen, I look up to Mr. Wismer quite a bit. And if he says it, then you can take that to heart because you know it's true.
Richie also. I mean, Mig made the salient point you know, if there's somebody that you sense you know, is feeling isolated and alone. Don't just say to yourself, I hope they're okay. No, make an effort. And if it's a circle, if it's a circle of friends, you know, reach out to the other friends and say, you know, find out, you know, what you can and then extend, you know, what could turn out to be a lifeline, literally.
Right, exactly. I mean, and we all need to be better at that. And I mean, and listen, these jockeys' lives, they are not like all peaches and cream like some people think. They struggle every single day, you know, to play our game, basically, you know. And it's just the void that's going to be left now with our Prescott Downs family will be immense. I can assure you of that. I mean, that kid would walk into a room, Steve, and he'd smile and he'd light it up. Mm. Like, he just made you feel, you know, that's just what he was. He was so unselfish You know, he would just, he just made you feel good when you were with him. And he was funny and he was witty. And you want to talk about a kid with raw talent? Steve, unbelievable. He can do anything on a horse.
Well, that, and that, I mean, and that, yeah, that's, that, that was, that was apparent. I do want to do one thing as we, as we close out the morning. There are multiple, and I'll put this on with today's listing. There's multiple assistance centers that are available immediately. There's the texting service, the text HOME home to 741-741. And it's 24/7, basically a crisis text line. And there's the underpublicized 988. 988 suicide and crisis lifeline on any phone. So I want to send that message out as we pay tribute to, and you're going please extend everybody's thoughts to the Wisnes.
Sure.
Okay,
absolutely. Yeah, right. Cass and I will be attending tonight, just obviously for us, because our relationship with Avery, yeah, but also, in regards to the Prescott Arms family. Because I know a lot of the horsemen, they're in Florida or they're at Oaklawn, and it's tough for all of us, especially those who have horses that have to take care of them.
Sure.
It's tough to get out of where you're at sometimes. So
well, I'm glad you're gonna be there. Pat Morrell, everybody, and of course Morrell Bloodstock, and during the season at Presque Isle. Pat, best wishes.
You too, Steve. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks to Pat and to Glenn Wismer and of course Mick for remembering and appreciating Avery Wisman, and hopefully a message out there that help somebody somewhere along the way. Thanks to Cherie DeVoe as well. And John White, some good action around today. If you're going to play, you got some little extra compared certainly to last Monday, where I think, what do we have? we have four places, I think, last week. Well, today you've got Fairgrounds, Golden Gate, Laurel, Mahoning, Parks, and Sam Houston. Good luck, everybody. We will talk to you tomorrow here on Sirius XM at the races. Take care of each other. Talk then.
On Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.